south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, let's start out with a little more info on organic and non-organic farming here in Latin America, especially here in Guatemala, since we have an expert who just chimed in after our last show talking about the common growing and fertilizing practices here in Central America. This time, we have none other than the famous Captain Mango chiming in. Because, you know, in a past life, Captain Mango, who's been down here in Latin America, I think now, almost 10 years, he and his family had a greenhouse and potted plant business on the outskirts of Cleveland. Yep, Cleveland. He supplied those slabs of seedlings or saplings, whatever you want to call them, that you see in all those garden centers at Kmart, Walmart, all those big chain grocery stores and hardware stores, etc. He's the guy with the green thumb, not me. And lately, for the last couple of years or so, he's been running a coffee plantation in the highlands that is the Altiplano of Guatemala, located about a half an hour due south of the Guatemala city limits, right off what they call Carretera Salvador, that's the Pan American Highway on the road to El Salvador. So anyway, let's defer to him about this fertilizer and herbicide biz. Oh, and by the way, all you guys and gals coming to the seminar in February. Captain Mango will be hanging with us the whole time, so you'll get to pick his brain on things like crypto, Bitcoin, and any kind of farming or gardening you may want to do down here once you plant a foot here in Latin America. Anyway, he says, in regards to growing papayas here in Guatemala at least, I doubt if they apply any herbicides to papaya. Now, he's saying that because I mentioned once in a while when I buy papaya, I see there's kind of a residue on them. Then Captain Mango says, and herbicides are a category of pesticide along with insecticide and fungicides. Then he says, I actually don't see much harm in using commercial fertilizer down here, other than the fact that it needs a lot of natural gas to create nitrogen fertilizer. So store-bought fertilizers can be energy hogs. Of course, he says, well-composted manure is better. It's a whole other learning curve, though, he says. And as far as chicken poop, which they use all over the place down here, if it's not completely composted, it's way too hot and will burn young seeds and plants. And if people are concerned about trace minerals often found in some commercial fertilizer blends, soil testing is necessary to see what you really need. In fact, he says, one year in Ohio, we had boron to add to our custom blend fertilizer. But you never know things like that unless you do soil testing. Then he says, Pepe Mountain, the small coffee plantation I work, needs a trace of sulfur for optimum fertilization. pH is of a major importance, too. Too acid, and it won't matter how much fertilizer you use, the plants just won't absorb it. The thing is, he says, if you want to adjust the pH of your soil, you can't just do it in a minute. You need to adjust it 6 months prior to fertilization. That's kind of a challenge here in Guatemala with 6 months of dry and 6 months of rain. Well, thanks for that, Captain Mango. You know, they don't call him Captain Mango for nothing. By the way, I remember when he first came down and got involved in the coffee growing business. It turns out our seminar lawyer, Jose, bought a couple of small acreage plantations and combined them. And Captain Mango would tell me back then that they harvested and grew coffee like they did it probably for hundreds of years. Seems like he said they were doing it the same way as they did it back in the 18th century, with absolutely zero soil testing. In fact, Captain Mango said he's the first guy to do it, on that particular piece of land anyway. And as it turns out, I remember him saying everyone has access to soil testing services, but there are so many hundreds, even thousands of small-time coffee farmers, some with just tiny plots of an acre or two. They just don't bother because they know year over year about how their crop's going to come in and the critters they have to deal with. In other words, when Captain Mango came in, he threw a little technology at the problem. And it's been nothing but good news and good harvests ever since. Though I could be wrong about that. So, as it turns out, most of the small-time coffee farmers down here have been doing things the same way, basically by the seat of their pants, for hundreds of years. And it works for them. But they're most definitely not at peak production or peak quality. And as you heard me mention on a past show, growing coffee is not for the casual gardener. It's a quite involved process. Look it up. It'll surprise you. It sure surprised me. In fact, one of the very cool things I noticed when I first got down here to Central America many years ago, when I'd be driving through the boonies, sometimes I'd see a kid with a rake spreading out coffee beans on a driveway slab in the sun. Every once in a while, you'd be driving through the boonies and you'd see these big 30 or 40 or 50 by 50 feet, what sort of looked like light brown carpets of coffee beans, just laying out in the sun during the harvest season, of course. That's how small-time coffee producers dry their beans, right out in the sun. And when they're dry, they're bagged once again and go to the roaster. Now, I remember one time, quite a while ago, I thought, you know, I drink a couple of cups of coffee a day and I grind my own beans, so why not just cut out the middleman, go to one of those little coffee producers, I knew where lots of them were, buy maybe a 10-pound sack of beans, take it to one of the roasting houses in Guatemala City, and I'd be set for who knows, maybe a year or two. By the way, there's an area of Guatemala City where if you drive through and just close your eyes and take a breath, it smells so great because that's where all the roasting companies are. So I did it. I bought a 10-pound sack of what they call green beans for around 20 bucks. Green meant not roasted yet. I took it down to the roasters in Guatemala City. It cost me another maybe $8 to have it roasted. And that was my first mistake. They said, how do you want it roasted? And I thought, you mean there's more than one way? This was before Starbucks, the internet, and gourmet coffee options. Anyway, I got it home, was so happy. It smelled so great. But it didn't taste all that great, not at all. And I had a nice grinder, too. And one of those Bodum French press coffee makers. So I should have extracted the best out of it, but it wasn't so. And things went downhill from there because I discovered about a month or two into the process, coffee does spoil. Or at least go stale after a couple of months. Now, I don't know, maybe if you put it in the freezer, you can extend the life, but I just know I gave away like about 8 pounds of that stuff. And the local Latinos, it was fine coffee for them. They are absolutely not discriminating coffee drinkers. Not like so many snobbish Americans, including my own sisters, who just have to have their Starbucks fix. Even today, in every Latin home you go into, except the very high-end ones, they use coffee percolators. And you know, that stuff's just boiling and reboiling and reboiling. It's like cowboy campfire coffee. Meanwhile, they've got the world's best coffee growing right down the street. And that's why when you drop into Starbucks, you know, Starbucks is everywhere, right? You don't see any of the common people. It's all the upper middle classes and wealthy. Or I should say a spattering of gringos and expats who don't know any better, and the entitled children of the Latin wealthy. And the key I've found to knowing whether you're going to get a great cup of coffee is if they've got a real Italian espresso machine. And you know, those things don't come cheap. So when you see a little hole in the wall corner restaurant or pastry shop, and they've got a machine like that, you know that the owner knows coffee and is trained up as employees. But still, I'd say a good 60 to 80% of the little corner restaurants and lunch counters still serve you percolated coffee. Ugh. Yep, even in the land of the best coffee in the world. And in the grocery stores, they have some real high-end brands, but 90% of this stuff is molido, or ground, which is not the way to make the best coffee. You have to grind your own. The lesson learned here? Don't buy too much coffee in advance. The stuff does have a shelf life. All right, let's take an email. This one comes from Mark. He says, Johnny, unfortunately, we're going to miss your seminar next month as we've already committed to visiting relatives in Virginia. Please, no judgments here. I know this may be your last seminar, but I'm hoping it's not. Anyway, we've been here in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador, since last Thursday. And I just want to warn you about the mask thing. These people in this country are fanatic about wearing the damn things, even when walking around outdoors. And it's not just here in the capital city. We rented a car and have been driving to see volcanoes, Mayan ruins, etc., and I've been barked at in Spanish by security guards, waitresses, and other well-meaning Batinskis all over the country. Coming from Florida, this has been a huge step backwards. We ditched the worthless things nearly a year ago and haven't looked back. It's been a culture shock, to say the least, but perhaps your seminar attendees from California, New York, Oregon, etc., will feel right at home. Maybe you should hit them with a seminar tax or make them a quarantine in their own hotel rooms for a week to cement home that shit feeling of being up in the States, in case they're missing it. Signed, Mark. By the way, Johnny, my uncle's name is Dave. All right, Mark, thanks for that boots on the ground report, but I got to tell you this. Sounds to me you did not mosey on over to the Pacific side of El Salvador with Bitcoin Beach, El Zante, and El Tunco, and all those little towns that are getting all that crypto press lately. All my friends down there are reporting to me that the mask thing is an absolute non-issue. especially since it's drawing the freedom-loving libertarian crowd, visitors, tourists, and investors. And you know what those guys are like. Some of them are real anarchists. In fact, lately I've been looking at some very recent YouTubes and on-the-spot video encounters right in that Bitcoin Beach area, and very few people are wearing masks. So, Mark, I believe you 100%. In all the big cities in Latin America, you see lots more idiotic mask wearing than you ever see as you're rolling out to the boonies, where it does peter out and fade away fast. And sadly enough, I have to tell you, the maskers are out in force in those gringoized areas of Mexico. When I was in Puerto Vallarta, just a couple of months ago, in fact, that's a very gringoized area. Number one giveaway, there are Starbucks every couple of blocks. Well, let me tell you, right outside the beachfront hotel I was staying at, there was a nice tree-lined boulevard and a jogging trail right down the middle of it. And every day, I'd see tons of gringos and gringas jogging on that trail, single, double-masked, and double-masked with face shields. Lemmings, all of them. And every day, or sometimes a couple times a day, when I'd cut through that jogging trail on my way to the mall across the street, I, being maskless, got a heaping helping of dirty looks from mostly middle-aged gringa joggers. I thought, is this an updated episode of the Twilight Zone or something? And now a report on even more COVIDiot lunacy. Here's an email from upcoming seminar attendee, Mr. W. He says, Johnny, I'm somewhat of a COVID travel testing victim, having traveled to Hawaii last March, and they were probably the most restrictive state there is. And they require you to use specific PCR testing vendors. Problem is, and we all know about the PCR inaccuracies, you can be positive something like 12 weeks after having gotten the COVID because it detects residual pieces of the virus as though you're still infected. But you're not. My advice to anyone who's traveling is to take the rapid antigen test if they have a choice, although it's highly inaccurate, unless you really want to be sure you don't have COVID. The thing is, you could test positive on the rapid antigen test, then take it again on the same day, and there's a good chance you'll test negative. Both, I've found out, are accepted by the Guatemalan government. Anyway, he says, if you try to game the system that insurance companies have set up to get them to pay for it, if you tell them you have symptoms or were exposed to someone with COVID in order to get insurance coverage, you're likely to get the PCR test. The problem is with the Omicron variant so easily transmissible and it's everywhere, there's a good chance you're going to test positive if you use the PCR test, even with no symptoms. My advice, keep away from that PCR test at all possible. You should take the rapid antigen test, and if it's negative, you're good. That said, he says, not sure if you're aware of some of the COVID testing craziness going on here in the States. I can understand that when admitted to a hospital, they want to test you for COVID. But now we're finding out that half the people hospitalized for anything at all are testing positive. That's the latest scare tactic. The thing is, everyone's tested when admitted. Yet at least half who tested positive were asymptomatic. For sure, testing is being driven by fear, and there are long lines at the free testing sites now. A couple of hours or more standing in line is not uncommon just to get a test. Many sites won't even book a reservation anymore. By the way, if you're flying, no sense to get tested the day before because the results might come back far too late and you might be a false positive. I've found it's best to get tested close to the 72-hour limit. Then if you test positive, it could be false, you can test again. Then he says you could be asymptomatic and test again at the airport because you might have turned negative in those 2 or 3 days. You don't want to risk that. He says there are lots of major airports that have testing sites, but they're more expensive than they need to be, of course. But you can get the results within 15 minutes if you take the rapid antigen one. All right, me Johnny here. I always say, take the rapid antigen test. Don't take the PCR. That's garbage. And you get the results a day or two later. Forget about it. Do the rapid antigen test. I do that one when I travel. It's never taken more than a half hour to get the results. Then Mr. W says, by the way, Guatemala and other Latin American countries say the test needs to be lab certified. Well, that just means any old lab and not a home-based test because, you know, there are lots of home tests out there now. He says that probably means that a printed document in your hand is necessary and not on a smartphone. All right, me Johnny here. Yep, have that paper handy. But it's good to have a copy on your phone. Then he says, I wonder if I download my negative test result and did a little photoshopping. Opens up lots of possibilities. Then he says, by me, there's a rapid antigen testing at my airport, but it's $250. Whereas the same test done at a nearby urgent care clinic is something like $75. All right, me Johnny here. Yeah, I've been getting those tests because I've been traveling all over and I'm paying around $35 to $40. Rapid antigen test only, obviously. I've never done it at an airport, just at one of those local corner clinics. And finally, Mr. W says, even local lamestream media outlets are predicting a statistical end to Omicron variant at the end of this month. Maybe the U.S. State Department will stop its meddling by the time it's necessary for me to leave the U.S. and come to the seminar. The CDC is starting to soften its hard line out of necessity, too. I guess the gig is up. All right, thanks for that, Mr. W. Yep, the gig is up, and I think even the average American zombie is starting to notice one or two of his own brain cells are waking up. And with this next email, we've got our listener, Peter, sending me a compliment. He says, Johnny, heard you call Anthony Falsey an idiot on your podcast today. I say calling Falsey an idiot's an insult to idiots. Meanwhile, he says, many thanks as usual for your oasis of intelligence and sanity. All the best, Peter. You know what, Peter? I'm not too good with compliments. Probably because I know so many people who are smarter than I am. And now, the absolute topper email of the day, maybe the week or month or year. This one's from Horst. How do you go through life with a name like Horst? No offense, Horst, just saying. I think it's time to slap your mom. He says, Dear Johnny, I've written to you before a long, long time ago on the topic of the fast-track degradation of the music business. Today I'm writing to you in response to your last show about the terrible state of Latino reggaeton music. Anyway, here goes. I understand you're a musician yourself, Johnny, but you don't talk much about it on your show. I think it's time for another go at it, though, especially about that reggaeton music. Music is a dead corpse, but the kids don't know it, and reggaeton leads the way, following in the dirty and talentless footsteps of rap and hip-hop, but that's obvious to anyone with an IQ over 80. I guess it's a kind of music, if that's what you want to call it, as you might call dogs barking at night. I get that it's reflecting nothing but the downsides of living an unmotivated, pointless life in big cities like L.A. or Miami. Like it or not, and I effing hate it, reggaeton is the soundtrack to the Latino lifestyle. Talk about vacant and hollow. Now, Johnny, I'm a music producer. I've got a file here with more than 11 million MIDI files, along with all the chord progressions and the drum beats to go with it. I've also got 800,000 MIDI, M-I-D-I, drum patterns from every genre of music possible. You can find them all on wearethemusicmakers.com. They're no secret. They're open source files. What I and so many other, quote, computer musicians do is steal entire sections of songs, apply some synthesizers and some good drum samples, and presto, you have a track that nobody in this world is ever going to notice is not original. People just wouldn't believe how common doing all this is. It's no different cutting, sampling, and pasting audio files. Us long-timers call it disposable music, the opposite of timeless, classic music. So then how did all this happen and the whole music system degrade to what it is today? Well, it started in the mid-70s. Something unforeseen happened. AIDS. A true black swan event in the music industry. That is what, in my opinion, killed disco and Motown and rock, but brought us back into producing truly great music again. But that creative peak was very short-lived, maybe 5 years. Then something called rap and hip-hop was born, when they really should have been aborted. Unfortunately, it resonated with every ignorant, no-talent, wannabe, blood and crip living in every ghetto in the country, and that contagion spread to Latin America, and they call it reggaeton. Worse yet, reggaeton practically erased the land of talent in Latin America, formerly the land of salsa, mambo, rumba, big horn and percussion sections, Tito Puente, and cool-ass Latin rhythm beats no one else could do. However, nowadays, you don't need any musical talent to succeed beyond your wildest dreams, at least for a year or two, then it's back to oblivion. In fact, it isn't music at all, only speaking in rhyme to other people's electronic beats, otherwise known as sampling, which my dad, in his day, would call stealing. You could go to jail for plagiarism back then. Nowadays, you get paid. In all my years in the music industry, I've seen Elvis take rockabilly to something called rock and roll, then witness the British invasion with the Beatles and the Stones, but never in my entire life have I witnessed something so negative as the incursion of rap and reggaeton. I'd say reggaeton is even more pointless and inane than rap, but equally socially damaging to young people. It's just amazing how these forms of so-called music have single-handedly destroyed every single thing that makes music a thing of lasting beauty and joy. If you want a snapshot of what's really wrong with the world today, just take the most popular reggaeton and rap lyrics. The initials you'll recognize are MF, the N-word, and the word hoe, not a farm implement. Those words are repeated over and over in all the rap and reggaeton songs. It's just a running commentary about disaffected, uneducated, jobless, cretin, inner-city gangsters' fantasies and fairy tales. Just listen to one hit song, dissect it, then wonder why the educated Black and Latino communities aren't up in arms about it. Conclusion, they're just spineless. I'm only glad that I finally found this forum to voice my total disgust of this so-called art form. But believe me, I'm not the only one. My many sound engineer friends and buddies, especially the old-timers, are right there with me, but they have to eat, don't they? So how can I prove this as to not sound like an old fool just running off at the mouth? Well, consider this. How many songs from the 60s and 70s have stood the test of time? That's 50 years now. How many songs from those eras are considered classics now? Answer, a metric ton. The songs from those eras are timeless and people still listen to them today. Moreover, people will listen to those songs years and years from now and enjoy them as much as people did back in the day. Now ask yourself, how many songs can you remember from just the past 10 years ago? 5? Even 3 years ago? The Macarena, maybe? How many songs over the past 30 years do you think will be remembered in 50 years' time as compared to the 60s and 70s? Answer, almost none. It's not even a fair fight. The songs of today are written to hit the sweet spot, provide a few empty calories of an enjoyment, and make that few quick bucks, and then disappear down the ghetto nursery rhyme sewer hole. And that's why, Johnny, music of today is complete and utter shit. Me and my cronies are not just a bunch of old fogey recording engineers turning the knobs, saying, oh God, the kids of today and their music, what crap. Nope, it's about the commercialization and assembly line construction of music over the past 20 or 30 years. Us OGs in the music production business will tell you that yesteryear was really 1,000% better than the music of today. No comparison. In fact, most of us agree that music today is not really music. It's just a callous representation of music, a soulless, vapid, vacuous black hole of infinite shite masquerading as music. No subtlety, no soul, no heart, no nothing. Just a bunch of little ego shouting, look at me, my tattoos, my piercings, my horrific dental appliances and mutilated body parts. There is another huge factor here, too. Music that became classic long ago was written and performed by people who grew up before the age of TV, before iPhones and the internet. People from that era actually spent vast amounts of time in the basement studying how to play, learning from other great musicians and literature that provided inspiration for meaningful lyrics that told the story. Lyrics are the other part of the music equation. Real talents are educated or autodidacts, as opposed to today's typical pop star who's grossly ignorant and talentless by comparison. Take away the flash Hollywood production video values and you have mediocre high school talent show quality at best. Have you ever considered that we have electronic voice changers, auto tuners, tone modulators in every studio now that can make anyone sound powerful and edgy, even make a drunk sound on key? In fact, I suggest anyone who wants to seriously learn about music as it should be played and sang by real talent should listen to the Rick Beato podcast, R-I-C-K-B-E-A-T-O. He's a music teacher and producer of exceptional range, talent, and ingenuity. His podcast is listened to by the likes of Brian May, Sting, and the best jazz artists of the world. He's always talking about how real talent has been degraded since rap and hip-hop came along and bemoans the dumbing down of the Grammys and virtually all the so-called music awards shows, too. It's all theatrics, bombs, and glitter at live shows to distract the audience from the thin sound quality of the singer, though auto-tune and tone modulators clean that up too. But the audience doesn't know that. Yes, you don't even have to be on key in the studio anymore or on stage. Screw talent. That's why so many bands are terrible live, but their show and pyrotechnics are great. Unless they're singing through a voice decoder, they're almost never on key. Think about that next time you tune into a music show like the Grammys and see Snoop Dogg duetting with an even less talented, pierced and tattooed rapper or reggaetonero, arm-waving, finger-pointing, and doing a spastic colon dance. Yet, every entertainment interview has tomorrow's soon-to-be-bankrupt one-hit wonder gushing about how the next forgettable act on the card is a golden ghetto-bred musical genius with street and prison cred. Even us studio engineers have to be PC and suck it up. If a recording engineer producer would dare to say the truth that the latest ghetto discoveries a no-talent prick, the entourage ass-kissers and hangers-on will call you racist and actually try to get you fired, pulled off the project, or canceled. even though it's precisely your job to make him or her sound like the professional he isn't. In fact, that's why they hire you, because you can tweak the electronics to make a pig's oink sound like a Beyonce contender. Johnny, a final word about reggaeton music. It's a huge industry now, employing thousands along with millions of hideously tattooed, pierced, and disfigured wannabes. But I have to admit, the ladies absolutely love dancing and bumping and grinding to it. Admittedly, they're not in it for the inane and repetitively insane lyrics that any mentally challenged fourth grader could pen. Did I say pen? I meant utter or belch, since half of them can't even say or construct a normal coherent sentence or could pass a fourth grade English test. Nor a urine test, for that matter. Funny how musical lyrics used to involve a bit of poetry. Some songs' lyrics could stand alone as a well-thought-out story, but nowadays, if you separate the lyrics from the so-called music, even an anthropologist couldn't tell if a real-life human or Kyoko the gorilla wrote them. Meanwhile, my music industry lawyer brother tells me all the time that 90% of rappers and reggaetoneros who had a number one song or even multiple hits are dead broke or bankrupt by the time they're 35. They have their 15 minutes, then they hole up in Miami or the Hollywood Hills. Soon enough, they're 8 rent payments behind on the Lambo, sitting on their gold-plated crappers with zero talent or aptitude to do anything else but flip burgers and guzzle crystal champagne. Sorry, Johnny, for the rant. Just had to get that off my chest. There are so few of us old school guys left who remember what good music was really like. We're dying off, and some of us are looking forward to meeting some of our heroes who had real talent in the afterlife. Signed, Horace K. P.S. Best music movie in the last 20 years called Whiplash from 2014. It's a must-see. Every musician I know, real musician, raves about it. Did you know, Johnny, as of about 2005, all major studios have metal detectors, since rappers and reggaetoneros have that small penis, big gun, fourth grade ghetto macho sickness seared into their peanut brains. Yes, there are actual murders in the studio. Sure, it was kind of a joke back when Elvis, Keith Richards, Johnny Cash, or Phil Spector would bring a gun into the studio, but they're almost never loaded, though Spector would fire a few shots into the ceiling when things weren't going well. But it's a real rapper and reggaetonero threat now, popping each other off, even in the studio. Guns N' Roses never even brought guns. Funny thing, though, sometimes us engineers would joke about leaving a few loaded guns around on purpose and not show up ourselves. Certainly, fewer rappers and reggaeton rats would be good for the music industry. Every clogged toilet is in dire need of a flush. Unfortunately, the loss of a few key a-holes like Kanye and Bad Bunny, the lost revenue would put lots of good engineers out of work.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.